All data are collected using one of three major methods. Behavioral observation, when the data are obtained by human recording and or coding of participants' behaviors. This doesn't mean that we don't use instruments, but at some point, somebody has to look at that behavior and turn it into data. Or they have to create a program to look at those data and turn it into behavior. At some point, humans are creating the data collection or the data coding process. Self-report data. When data are obtained from participants' written or spoken responses to researchers' prearranged questions. The a priori prearranged part of that is very important. And trace data. When data are obtained from the marks or the remains left by the behavior of the respondent. Now, these three categories work broadly. They'll be useful. I am not going to try and write questions either on the for the EDU exercises or for the exams that try and hit in between and are miserable. Okay? Can I write a test you can't pass? Sure. That's not the point. The point of the test is being able to recognize clear examples of these different kinds of categories and procedures and typologies. One of the distinctions that the fussier among us make is that not all written or spoken responses are self-report. Self-report is only those in response to questions from the researcher. So coding a response of the participant to a question asked by the researcher, we'd call that self-report data. Coding the response of one participant to the same question asked by another participant would be considered observational data. In observational data, there's a certain amount of getting lucky. You're not sure what behaviors you're going to see. You're not sure what questions are going to ask each other, what answers you're going to get. Part of what you're doing in self-report data is you are taking over and making sure that you get these explicit pieces of information. So let's take a look at each of these. All right, when we're talking about observational data collection, observational data collection comes in two basic kinds, naturalistic observation and participant observation. In naturalistic observation, the participants don't even know they're being observed. You've watched the Discovery Channel. Disney. Certain websites. Trying to figure out how much I can get away with here. The whole idea of naturalistic observation is that they don't know they're being observed. The two basic techniques of naturalistic observation are camouflage and distance. You've seen all the cool things that they dress up in, the little huts they build, pretending they're a tree. Okay? Camouflage. Distance and a good lens can keep you from knowing that they're being observed. Now we're talking science here. You just see the way some of you are giggling. Participant observation, they know that someone is there. They know that someone is there. What they might not know is why you're there. In undisguised participant observation, the someone is an observer who is in plain view. This is the person looking at child play behavior that walks into the playground and leans up against the fence with a clipboard. And in most places nowadays, you better have that clipboard, and probably should have talked to the community group, or they will run your ass out of there, maybe with things sticking out of it. Playgrounds are a different place than they used to be. And disguised, the observer looks like someone who belongs there. Now, you can't always do disguised participant observation. You can try, but it depends on the population and the setting. The advantages of naturalistic observation, it offers the best external validity. Gives you the best chance of getting natural behavior, natural actions, because they don't know they're being observed. It's important to point out that if you're doing naturalistic observation, you can have experimental or non-experimental designs. You can have random assignment and manipulation without them knowing there's anything going on. Classic cases of this are what are known as the letter drop technique. a researcher with an earphone in is walking along. Meanwhile, somebody's watching all of this, and they're flipping coins to decide who's going to be selected. They tell you, in your earphones, you sit down beside the person. And now you've got two envelopes in your pocket. One envelope has your name and a bunch of money. The other one has your name and very little money. Somebody's flipping a coin and they tell you which envelope to leave as you get up and walk away. I now have random selection, I've got random assignment, I've got manipulation. The behavior that I want to watch is going to take place over the next several minutes because there's an address on that envelope and there's a mailbox sitting right there. I've got internal validity, I've got nice external validity, I've got a true experiment, and I've got naturalistic observation. There's nothing about the data collection technique that rules out certain research designs. You have to separate that and ask two separate questions. Disadvantages and challenges, limited to studying behavior. Important ethical point. We are allowed to observe public behavior. What is public behavior changes fairly dramatically across states and even cities. In some places, if you're outside with a camera and they're outside doing whatever they want, that's public behavior. Sometimes if you're inside and they're outside, that's still public behavior. Most places, if you're outside and they're inside, that's not public behavior. It requires a reliable, accurate coding to produce useful data. It's one thing to watch behavior, to tape it, to record it. It's something else to turn it into data. And that coding part is always part of the challenge. Yes?
Where do you put observational data in a lab?
Most data in a lab is observational because, for example, if you're sitting there hitting computer keys, that's observational.
But they know they're being observed.
They know they're being observed, but they might not know why, for example. I wouldn't make that naturalistic observation. But it's observation because we are recording their ongoing behavior as opposed to asking them a question. Great question. And here's an example of naturalistic observation. Killing the participants is usually not part of naturalistic observation. You have to make sure that your observational technique does not change their behavior or kill them. That's what this is all about. Undisguised participant observation. In undisguised participant observation, you're there, they know you're there. Behavior can be very natural after participants have become used to the observer. There's two different things that we use, habituation and desensitization. And we'll use some of Dan Ledger's earlier work with ground squirrels as an example. If you drop yourself into the middle of a ground squirrel nesting area, everybody disappears down the hole. Okay? Hard to see behavior when they're down a hole. So you need to get them up there behaving naturally. In habituation, you walk in, sit down, and outwait the little critters. You wait until they're willing to come up, sniff around, not scream and cry to each other, until they're up and they're engaging naturally. That's habituation. Sit up and outwait them. Desensitization is basically to creep up on them, but they know you're creeping up on them. So you may start 100 yards away and they're doing fine. And you get a little closer and then they settle down a little bit. Another great example of this is when we were all in grade school and the principal used to come in to see how the teacher was teaching. And I don't know about you, but every once in a while I'd forget she was there and act like me. Sort of habituate and go back to essentially natural behavior and get nailed, this time not by the teacher, but by the principal. Again, experimental and non-experimental designs can be used. The way we're collecting the data does not drive the type of design we have. We are limited to studying behavior with any observational technique. And over the years, psychology has shifted from being defined as the study of behavior to being designed as the study of behavior and mental life. Well, it's hard to do mental life watching somebody. Again, we run into the ethical point of public behaviors, and the simple fact that some behaviors in participants won't habituate or desensitize. And in order to know, you have to know that research literature, and you find out that ground squirrels habituate and desensitize really, really well. Fox squirrels don't. People who have studied them in undisguised participant observation and naturalistic observation have consistently found different things. They're just more nervous. They never really settle down and act like themselves if they can tell you're there. And once again, at some point, we have to turn those data, or we have to turn those observations into data. Disguised participant observation. Now you're disguised. You look like someone who belongs there. Participants don't know that they're being observed and they should act naturally. You have access to less public behavior among peers. This is when you actually dress up and pawn yourself off as a member of the target population. The disguised researcher could change the behavior of the participants. This is one of the problems. When somebody joins a club or joins a group or attends something, in order to see that less public behavior among peers, they may change the behavior that they're observing. Makes it difficult. I want to point out that, again, you can have experimental or non-experimental designs. We're limited to studying behavior. We have an important ethical point still, and I'm sorry, to a greater extent now, because we are now intruding on their private. And we have to make sure that what we're doing is properly vetted and evaluated by the Institutional Review Board and the other ethical guidelines that we'll talk about on Friday. I didn't put it down here because it's sort of funny, but you can't always pretend to be a member of the target population. I mean, if I want to observe the behavior of children, there's really nothing I can do to pawn myself off as a six-year-old. Okay? Even worse, there's no way I can dress up and look like a ground squirrel. So sometimes you're limited to choosing between undisguised when they know they're there and you're counting on habituation and desensitization, or naturalistic observation where through either camouflage or distance you have removed yourself but can still observe the behavior. And as always, when we're observing behavior, at some point we have to turn it into data. The collection of observational data. My first real out-of-the-laboratory research was looking at errors and information use by military field mechanics, which means I was out there, sun, rain, mud, snow, all the fun stuff that happens where there's battles and wars and things like that, watching people who were fixing things and coding the right things they did, the mistakes that they made, and when and why they sought what sort of information. It literally was a written narrative. I wrote down everything as fast as I could and went back and turned it into codes. Nowadays, this would go easier. You can get, you know, high density or high definition cameras this big. They're a little expensive, but compared to carrying around tablets, you spend the jack. Audio recordings, pictures and video recordings, nonverbal behaviors, reaction time, eye movements, and all of the medical physiological stuff all counts as observational data. We are getting information from them during their ongoing behavior. That's what makes it observational data. It isn't necessarily that I'm staring at it. Okay? Any sort of instrumentation is still observational data collection. And of course, instrumentation increases the availability and the accuracy of the data. The really great thing about an audio or video recording is you can go back and recode it multiple times to make sure if you're right. You can have different people code it to make sure that you agree. And if you come up with a new idea that you weren't coding for when you were doing it live, you can go back and pick it up off the tapes. We had a large project here 2 or 3 years ago where one of the graduate students realized that in an earlier study, they had videotaped all of the sessions And they'd only pulled four pieces of information off of those tapes because that's what was being studied that time. They went back and looked at some of those tapes and realized that she could test a series of hypotheses about the interactions between therapists and clients that hadn't even been thought of when these tapes were made several years before. That's the advantage of permanent recordings of observational behavior. We can turn this into much cooler data down the line.